The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. Those of you who have listened to the Q&A show from the end of last week, we've got a same special guest on for the EDU show. I kind of teased that he might be back for our EDU this week, and that's Paul, part of the three taxateers, as Jim refers to them, the CPA team that works with us here at our firm, helping our clients. And he agreed to come on to talk about a topic or two that requires kind of lengthy discussion rather than the Q&A format from last week. So Jim's got, I think one of these topics is from an email that Jim received. Another one was, I think, just a topic that Jim found fascinating. But welcome back again, Paul.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's kind of you to join us again, and we'll get Jim in so we can dive into the topic pretty shortly.
Welcome, everybody.
Some
Thank
time
you.
Constraints, so we'll dive right in here.
We do. Not much time for bantering. One thing I do want to make mention, as Chris and I always do, we're recording this several days in advance. So if anything major happens between Easter weekend and Wednesday the 3rd? I'm not sure what that is in April.
This should play on the 3rd, yeah.
It's not that we're ignoring it. It just hasn't happened yet. So I always want to throw that out there when we record this far in advance. Normally, Chris and I record these the day before, sometimes the day of, but normally the day before. This time we're recording it several days before. Yeah. Okay, so what we wanted to do is get Paul back on for the EDU aspect. I think you did really good, Paul, on the Q&A show. Did you feel comfortable last week?
I did. I didn't think too many arrows were thrown my way, so I felt pretty good.
We were nice to you. We were nice to you. Chris kind of hogged the show a little bit, but outside of that, I think we were nice,
especially that last discussion we had where Chris definitely hogged the show.
Oh my
you
god!
Remember that,
special
Chris?
Needs trust. He didn't shut up on that. Unbelievable!
I just love those. I just can't get enough of special needs trust.
Yeah, you're picking up on what I've picked up on, Paul. Tried doing this podcast with him for the past 12 years. I barely can get a word in edgewise. But hey, sometimes you just got to be a little more aggressive and just get it right in there. Okay, so this first topic, I asked you to come back on for an EDU. Our hope, folks, if we can keep Chris in line, is to answer a question on capital gains taxes from a CPA perspective of how they work. They even confuse me. As we know, Chris and I put cap gains taxes in what category, Chris? Always, maybe, or never?
Cap gains or maybe?
Maybe. But we've never really talked about what the hell we mean by maybe. And then we got an email that pretty much is saying, what the hell do you mean by maybe? And I thought this would be a perfect email and a perfect topic for an EDU. And then Paul said, well, I can pretty much wrap that up probably in 30 minutes. So do you want another topic? And I said, well, you know what? I once read an article on the wash sale rule. And I'd love to be able to talk about it because, again, it seems so simple. Everybody knows the wash sale rule, but this article really delved into it and got you thinking, wow, there's a little bit more here. And Paul said, I could easily do a half hour on the wash sale rule as well. So that's why we brought Paul back. So honestly, and I know y'all are going to be laughing on this, Paul's going to do most of the talking today. And I'm going to do the reading of the question, and then Chris and I will kind of add some feedback from a financial planning perspective. But we really want Paul to dive deep into cap gains and wash sale. So the email question that got the cap gains going, very simple. And I like this. This guy, like me, folks, he came to the point, simple, straight. That's it. He wrote, can you explain how capital gains work? Maybe use an example of $50,000 from a taxable income and $50,000 from maybe taxable income and how all that calculation would work. So put another way, $50,000 saved Paul from an IRA, always taxable, and selling $50,000 of, let's say, cap gain, $100,000 now of income. How does all that work?
Yeah,
I'll hand that off to you, Paul.
Okay, thank you. Now, before we get started, we're using the word cap gains, but it isn't just capital gains from selling stocks, bonds, etc. It also includes qualified dividends. So we're going to use that as a generic, you know, for all that type of income. So you add long-term capital gains, qualified dividends together, that's all going to be what we call cap gain income.
Good point, yeah.
So the way to look at taxes is you have two buckets. I'll use the word buckets. You have bucket A, which is your regular tax, and you have bucket B, which is your capital gains tax. So in bucket A is always calculated first. So that's that IRA distribution of $50,000 that the person said, I received $50,000 from an IRA, and I have $50,000 from selling some stocks, a gain from selling stocks. So we're going to take that $50,000 of IRA income. Let's pretend like there's no other income in, as far as ordinary income. We then subtract your itemized deductions, your IRA, your whatever other deductions you might have, and you're going to come down to taxable income based on bucket A. So let's just, as an example, you got $50,000 IRA distribution, and you got you're married, you have $30,000 of standard deduction, whatever deduction. So you're down to $20,000 of taxable income. You're then going to look at the tax tables, and 10% is the first tax, and it's on roughly $20,000. I'm just going to assume that it's on $20,000. So you're going to owe $2,000 of tax on that $50,000 IRA distribution. Then we pile on top of bucket A, bucket B. So A is first, B is second. That $50,000 of capital gains is stacked on top of bucket A. Remember, bucket A has got $20,000 of taxable income. Well, capital gains have three separate tax rates. You have a 0% tax rate, you have a 15% tax rate, and then you have a 20% tax rate. Now, on top of it, we can have net investment income tax. We may or may not get into that, but let's just key on 0, 15, and 20. Now, where does the zero capital gains tax rate come in? If you're a single person, it's taxable income between 0 and $47,025, and I'm going to round some of these dollars. That's for 2024. It's indexed each year. For a married couple, it's not quite, it is exactly half of that. It's double that. Yeah. It's between zero and $94,050. So in this situation, remember we had $20,000 of bucket A income. We're going to add on $50,000 of bucket B income. If they're single, that we're going to be at $70,000. So the income, the capital gains from $20,000 up to $47,025 are going to be taxed at zero. And then the income between $47,025 and $70,000 will be taxed at 15%. Now, if you're a married couple, none of that capital gains is going to be taxed because $70,000 is less than $94,050. So again, the way to look at it is you take bucket A, calculate that first, then you add on top of it bucket B, and as long as it's below that, it's the old 15% bracket. It's not exactly the 12% bracket. It's off by a few hundred dollars, but it's the old 15% bracket. If you're below that, the amount that's below that between bucket A and that cliff of 94,000 or 47,000 for single, that's going to be at zero. Now, once you go above that, it's taxed at 15% up to a single person of 518,900. Married couple, they don't get much of an advantage. It's 583,700. Then once you go over those numbers, then it's taxed at 20%. So I'll stop and wait for any questions from Jim or Chris on that.
Yeah, I think that's a big point of confusion when people hear those brackets, I guess we could call them, of where that 0%, 15%, and 20% rate on capital gains and qualified dividends comes in. They look at it, at least in their mind, as its own separate little tiers. They're separate brackets that only deal with that. They don't realize that cap gains stand on top of the other ordinary income that you might be receiving that are going through these ordinary income tax brackets. It's I think a very common area of confusion. And even though you might have very, you know, reasonable or small cap gains, thinking that it's so small you're going to pay zero, but if you're recognizing those cap gains in a year that you've got a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of income because you're working, you suddenly realize that every bit of your cap gains is taxed at 15. You don't get any benefit of this mysterious 0% bracket because you pile it on top of. It's almost like I think in the past we've talked about it as a layer cake or I like your bucket idea or I usually say standing on top of to really emphasize that it's in addition on top. So it's and I think where we call it maybe is, you know, Paul, you focused on kind of how the taxes are applied to the gain. What we didn't get into, which we might want to talk about, is when is the gain recognized at all? When is it actually occurring, and what creates that? Because I'm also surprised with people that have these, quote, maybe taxable assets, they don't understand cost basis.
Right.
To even right. get to the gain in the first place, to then put in this scenario that you described. So maybe we should back up and talk about that.
Well, and as you mentioned, Chris, if you have a stock that you paid, let's say, $50,000 for, until you sell it for more than $50,000, there is no capital gain. It's basically tax-free. Now, where we have to be careful, and that's why I think ETFs are maybe, you know, sort of wiping out the advantage of mutual funds, is mutual funds, if they have a lot of transactions during the year, they are kicking out sort of a phantom. It's not phantom. It is a capital gains distribution that you have to pay tax on, even though you haven't sold anything. So that is the one area in investments where you are being taxed, even though, quote, you haven't sold it.
And what, you know, stocks, obviously, you mentioned you paid X amount for it. That becomes your cost basis for determining a gain or loss on a subsequent sale. But what about what comes up a lot of times? We talked a bit about a house issue last Q&A show. What about your, you know, your personal residence that can have cap gains attached to it when you sell it, or any real estate? Let's talk about a personal residence. The only reason I mention it obviously has that special treatment with the exclusion on a certain amount of the gain. But what about real estate or something like that? It gets more complicated as far as keeping track of that cost basis. What does that look like?
Yeah, so on a personal residence, I think most everybody knows that if you're single, you can have a $250,000 gain that's tax-free as long as you've lived in it for at least two of the last 5 years. Now, we have to be a little careful because if you start renting it out or you aren't using it as your personal residence, that gain exclusion can drop. But let's pretend like that you lived in it and then you just sold it. Now, where you have a rental, let's say you have a house that you've been renting out, you paid $300,000 for the house, you allocated $100,000 to the land, you got $200,000 cost basis on that house, you're able to depreciate that house over 27 and a half years. So let's say you've depreciated that house by $100,000. So now your tax basis on that house is $200,000, and you're going to sell it, let's say, for $500,000. Well, we got a couple different tax calculations there. That depreciation recapture under current law is taxed at a maximum 25% rate. It doesn't have the special 0, 15, and 20. It is simply considered to be sort of ordinary income, but your maximum rate is at 25%. Now, once you go above that $300,000, so the difference between $300,000 you originally paid for it and the $500,000 that you sold it for, that is what we call a Section 1231 gain, which in most situations is going to be exactly the same as long-term capital gains. So that sounds great. However, if you've sold, let's say, a rental a couple years ago, within the last 5 years, and you actually sold it at a loss, that is called a Section 1231 loss. So let's say you sold it at a $100,000 loss. Now you got a $200,000 long-term capital gain under Section 1231. Well, not all $200,000 is going to be taxed at those favorable capital gains rates. $100,000 will be ordinary income because that 1231 loss was deducted at ordinary loss rates. So you're going to have $100,000 taxed at a maximum of 25%. You're going to have $100,000 then that's taxed at ordinary rates after you've taxed it at 25, up to 25, and then you're going to have capital gains rates on top of it.
Yeah, so you can. That was a taste of income-producing property. Like a rental can be extraordinarily complicated. Make sure you're dealing with all that. That wasn't, I think, what this person was necessarily asking for, but just a heads up as to the complexity there. But even something as simple as your personal residence, also keep track of any documented improvements that you've made. Paul mentioned depreciation when you're using it as a income producing property that you're allowed to take, but the basis for the tax basis, which is just a specific application of a cost basis for tax calculations, can actually go up on a property like that. You're not going to improve stock that you owned, right? So the basis doesn't go up on something like that, but it could go up on your, particularly your personal residence, as people live in there for a while and finish the basement, or they do any number of things that are significant improvements. You want to keep documentation because that'll raise that cost basis and therefore reduce the amount of recognized capital gains that you'll face in the future. And particularly in states, or in locations, not particular states, but locations with highly appreciating real estate values over time, trying to get your basis up as high as possible before you sell it is advantageous. Because if you're in a property long enough, I mean, for the longest time here in Colorado, honestly, I didn't pay that much attention to it because I never, 25 years ago, imagined that I'd ever be in a house long enough to have $500,000 worth of gain in it. And I'm suddenly realizing that I'm not too far away from an event like that, just because I have been in a house for a very long time in the Front Range of Colorado, and we've had highly, high appreciation rates. And that isn't just Colorado here. There's lots of places around the country that's happening. So I'm scrounging around trying to dig up every piece of documentation I've got on improvements I've made to the house over time. So it's that basis that's critical in doing that first calculation, which is identifying the gain. And then we get to the two buckets that Paul was talking about and application of the actual taxes that are a result of those gains. So,
and as usual, Chris and I have hogged all the conversation. We haven't let Jim get any words in edgewise. Jim, do you have any words to add to that?
Yeah, do you have anything that you think we need to add to fully answer this particular person's questions?
That's my imitation of me snoring away. Nope, I think you guys did a good job.
Well, I was
worried there for a second that there was a another stroke.
You didn't like
event.
My impression
no,
of a sleeping
you scared
man?
The hell out of me because I thought there was.
I had a stroke.
I thought you were reaching for the microphone.
Sounds like a sleeping bear or something. You know.
Come on, that was my impression of snoring.
Well, okay. Now we know I can calm down.
I told you if I had a talent, which anybody listening to this podcast knows I lack talent. If I had a talent, what would I want to be, Chris? An impressionist, you know that.
Oh, I thought it was a circus performer.
Well, an impressionist, I guess, could be a circus. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I do want to add on one thing, because you have talked about the evils of trusts as far as from a tax standpoint, and we should cover how capital gains are taxed at the trust level if it's retained at the trust. There we have a very, just like the ordinary income tax rates, we have a very compressed nature there. In that situation, let's pretend like bucket A is zero. You know, you don't have any other ordinary income. So from zero to $3,150, and that's in 2024 numbers, it's taxed at zero. And then from $3,150 up to $15,450, it's taxed at 15%. And then above and beyond that, it's going to be taxed at 20%. So if you really wanted to be creative and you knew every year you're going to generate $20,000 of dividend, qualified dividend income, and you created six trusts that kicked out $3,150 and you just kept it in those six trusts, it would be tax-free, but you'd be paying a CPA or somebody else a whole lot of money trust to do a whole lot of better work. So I wouldn't. That isn't something I'd go down that rabbit hole.
Fun to think about, though.
So I just wanted to add that in. Another thing, if you have capital losses, you know, we talked about capital gains, but capital losses, those are allowed to offset capital gains. So your net number is what you're taxed on. Now, if your capital loss exceeds that capital gain, then each year you are allowed to deduct $3,000 against other ordinary income. And that number has not changed for 20, 30 years, 40 years. It's been a long time since that number changed. Now, one thing you have to be aware of is, like with a lot of other tax attributes, if you pass away with a large capital loss, it disappears forever. It does not get passed on to the spouse. It doesn't get passed on to the heirs. So in that year where you know you're in bad health and you got a long-term capital loss carryover, you know, you might want to consider selling some assets that have capital gains. Now, if it goes through your estate, you're going to get a step up, so maybe it really doesn't matter. But that is one thing to be aware of, is that your share of that capital loss carryover will disappear upon your death.
We did a whole podcast on that, and we talked about gifting the asset. It's better to gift the asset at a loss before you die than die with the loss.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because especially if it's going to a related party, that person that gets that asset, let's say it's Google stock and you paid $100 a share and it's now worth $50 a share. When it goes over to that person, its basis for that person is $50. But if they sell it between $50 and $100, it's basically tax-free to them. They're only going to be taxed on anything above the $100 level.
Exactly. And what we mean by that, and we don't want to go too deep in this because we did a whole show on it, but in Paul's example of a stock that was bought for $100, dropped to $50, if you die with it with a loss, the person inherits it, but their basis steps down to $50.
Yep.
So as that asset recovers to $100, what you initially purchased it at, and then they want to sell it at $100, they will have a $50 per share capital gain. But had you just gifted it to them before you died, now it works like this. Their basis really depends on what they sell it at. If they get it at $50 from you while you're alive, even if you died the next day, they got it from you while you were alive. If they sell it at less than $50, say they sold it at $25, their basis they can use is $50, what they got it from you at. And they would be able to take a $25 per share loss. If they sold it for more than $100, remember, you bought it originally at $100. Let's say they sold it at $200. Their basis would be your original basis, not the basis you gifted it to them at. In this example, $50. It would be your original basis, $100. And they would owe a $100 gain per share because I said they sold it at $200. But Paul is absolutely right, as he should be, as a very intelligent CPA. If, again, you gifted it before you died, rather than them inheriting it, that amount from $50, the date of value death, but you gifted it to him before you died at 50 rather than inheriting at 50. The dollar amount from 50 up to your original basis, 100, is a gray area. It's free money in the sense if they sold it anywhere between 50 and 100, it's tax free. But that's because you gifted it to them before you died.
Well, technically it's gain free because the sale price and the basis are equal. So there's correct. No recognized gain between that range, which leads to no taxes owed. But yeah. Technically it's zeroing the gain, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to die. Just like we talked about in the EDU show that Paul was on, you can do kind of deathbed planning with upstream gifting. And of course, there's that 1 year wait, but give it to someone else. We covered that briefly. This is another kind of deathbed thing you can do. If the cards are in and you're going to pass, yep, but you have losses.
Gift losses. Yeah.
Gift
yeah.
it yep. to the same person. You don't have to give it to someone else. There's none of that rule. Just gift it. Make it a completed gift before you pass. And they can get some tax benefits. Again, it's kind of morbid planning, but it's just something out there to think yeah. of. But the reason I'm glad you came on to talk about this, and we can't talk about cap gains without cap losses, and that's why I wanted this to be a twofer.
What I want to talk, before, just to clarify something with Paul, is that you talked about loss carry forward. So if you have a capital loss and you can't offset it with, you know, against gains in income in a given year, you can carry it forward and then continue doing that. I believe here just a couple years ago, didn't they change where there used to be limitations on how long you had to do that? And aren't those gone now so that you have no time limit? So even if it takes you 15, 20 years, you can eat it up throughout that time. Yep. They just don't let you carry it back anymore, which they used to.
Well, let's back up. So let's say you generate a $100,000 capital loss carry forward and you carry it forward to 2025 and you have a $50,000 capital gain. You get to wipe out that whole $50,000 and then deduct another three. So now you have a $47,000 capital loss carry over to 2026 and so on. You're correct until you pass away. Now, there is one area, and it deals with investments. You can have what's called Section 1256 capital gain or losses. That's futures contracts. So you're trading pork bellies or gold or silver on the future exchange. If you have a net loss on those, you can actually carry those back up to 3 years to offset 1256 gains. You can't offset capital gains. I know that's a little esoteric, but it is surprising how many taxpayers in my career that I've seen have 1256 most of the time losses, but there are some 1256 gains, so that is something you can do.
Okay, great. Okay, Jim, we can head wherever you want now.
Well, where I was going to go with this is you can't talk about capital gains without talking about capital losses, and Paul touched on a lot of the capital loss rules. But one thing I did want to get into was the wash sale rule.
Yep.
Because that is interesting. So I'm going to just give a little background here. So everybody kind of knows you can't sell something at a loss and buy it back within a 30-day window. What a lot of people don't know is that 30-day window is on both sides of the date of sale. So it's actually a 61-day window. 30 days before the date of sale, and 30 days after the date of sale. You cannot buy that asset. Now, we're going to get into the wash sale rule now because it gets confusing. It truly does.
You said it kind of absolutely. You can do that. It just affects your recognition of the loss.
Right.
So can do it.
Yeah.
You're not prevented.
I'm trying to lock in the loss. Thank you, Chris, for clarifying that. Yeah. The wash sale rule just prevents you from benefiting from the loss at that time. As Paul will explain, you don't lose the loss unless you putz around with a brokerage and an IRA. Then, you're going to lose the loss. Paul can explain how that works. But when I say you won't lose the loss, it will be added the loss that is disallowed for that tax year, would be added to the basis of the asset that caused you to breach the wash sale rule. It'll be added to that basis, thereby reducing the taxes in the future when you sell it, but you just won't get the benefit that tax year. So if you were looking to benefit that particular tax year because you might have had a large cap gain from selling a home or an investment property or a piece of land or other assets at gains, and you thought you would do some year-end tax planning, you might blow it for that year. So the thing to remember with the lost sale rule, excuse me, the wash sale rules, a couple important things. First, after 2013, the IRS, I don't know if it was the IRS rule, if they did a revenue ruling or if Congress made the rule, but your custodian, the broker helping you do the sale, they're the ones who are going to make the determination and report to the IRS if you violated the wash sale. That can cause some consternation because it gets difficult to understand what's substantially identical. That's, well, and the IRS hasn't defined substantially identical. I think they added that to the rule, if you will, in the 1950s. The article I read said 1954, yeah. Assuming the article is right.
Jim, we need to back up a second. The custodian will only keep track of the wash sales if it happens within that account. You know, if you have an account at Charles Schwab and you have an account at Vanguard, and Vanguard, you have the transaction that causes the wash sale. Well, you sell the stock at a loss in Vanguard and then buy it over in Charles Schwab. Vanguard isn't going to know that. So it's only if the wash sale happens in that account. I just wanted to clarify that.
Good point. That's what we get Paul on there to add that bit of clarity. But the point I wanted people to know is your custodian is kind of the eyes and ears for the IRS. And they're having to report if they feel the violation. It'll be on the 1099, I believe, but Paul can add clarity to that as well.
1099-B.
If they feel you violated the wash sale. And it's if it's a substantially identical asset, which they being the IRS, has defined. So to me, it causes a whole host of issues. Could you theoretically sell Ford at a loss and buy GM? Is that substantially identical? I could argue both ways. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. What if you sold Rivian and bought Tesla to electric car manufacturers? Is that substantially identical? What if you sold Tesla at a loss but bought Ford? Well, Ford's not a dedicated electric car company, but they do have an electric car division. You see how muddied it gets? It gets even worse, folks. What about mutual funds and exchange-traded funds now? What if you sold a mutual fund that tracks the S&P 500 but bought an ETF that tracks the S&P 500? Is that substantially identical? One's a mutual fund, one's an ETF. What if you had a actively managed large cap fund and you sold it as a loss, but you bought a passively managed S&P index fund? Is that substantially identical? Would you have to get into the actual holdings of the fund to see? The active fund might hold equities not in the S&P that the passive managed S&P index fund does own. This is where it starts to get muddied on what is a substantially identical asset. And then, Paul, add some clarity where the IRS in 2008, I believe it was, I think it was later in 2013, at some point in time, doesn't matter when, the IRS cleared up a few things where people were trying to sell something at a loss in their brokerage account, but be buying it in their IRA, which is titled differently.
I'm going to give you credit. You had the right year. It's 2008. It's Revenue Ruling 2008-5. Okay. So, yeah.
And that one is a little harsher, as Paul will explain.
Yeah.
And what about married couples? What if a husband sells something for a loss in his account, but the wife buys it in her account? Is that a violation of the wash sale rule? when you start looking at all these nuances, it's not hard to fall victim to the wash sale rule. And Paul is right. If you sold, for all you Vanguard VGs out there, if you sold something at a loss at Vanguard and you turned around and bought it at Fidelity, yeah, Vanguard's not going to know that it was a violation. Fidelity's not going to know you just sold something at a loss. And the IRS is not tracking what you actually buy. And unless you got audited, which is slim to no chance, no one's ever going to find out. So what do you do about the wash sale rule? Well, you got to be careful when you have one custodian. Does this mean you should have two accounts at two different custodians if you want to play that game? Biggest risk would be you happen to get audited during this time period. And again, the worst that's going to happen, unless you're involved in an IRA, is that loss will be disallowed in that tax year. You'll probably have to file an amended return because that loss isn't going to be allowed. And then it's going to have to get added to your basis. And if you already sold it, then you're going to have to re-add it and file an amended return for that year as well. And it could become a nightmare. But again, they're only going to catch you if you're audited. Yeah. Until they start trying to pass laws that say your actual holdings and your actual purchases need to be reported, and that they actually have software and computer system that would be able to determine this immediately. They can't do that now, but I bet you within 10 years, yeah. AI could do that at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, that day's
and
coming.
And will the IRS start using something like that? So I'm getting a little deep there, but I'm just trying to give you a little color background to why I wanted Paul to chat a bit about the wash sale rule. Because again, we kept trying to talk about gains. Well, you can't talk about a gain only without doing the mirror opposite losses. So I'll hand that off to Paul and Chris. Feel free to opine any way you want.
Well, I think there's three or four things there that I need to discuss. So first, on the custodians, in my opinion, this is my opinion, it's basically what I've seen, the only time they're going to do a wash sale is based on the ticker. So if it's KO, and you sell that at a loss and buy KO, Coca-Cola, back within 30 days, either before or after, they're going to apply the wash sale. If you have a ETF that tracks the S&P and the ticker symbol is, let's say, IWV, and you buy IWX, the custodian's not going to treat that as a wash sale, at least in my opinion. I've never seen it. It's almost always based on ticker. Now, that doesn't mean the wash sale rules aren't going to apply. You're still ultimately responsible to determine whether the wash sale rules apply. Now, on the case where you were doing your loss in a taxable account, and then in your IRA or your self-directed 401k or wherever it was at, you then went ahead and bought that stock either 30 days before or 30 days after, Jim is correct. In 2008, they came out with a revenue ruling that says that in that case, you don't get to deduct that loss at all, and you don't get to take that disallowed loss and add it to the basis inside of the IRA. Well, you could add it to the basis inside the IRA. That's irrelevant, but you don't get to add it to basis to the IRA. So you permanently lose that loss. That's pretty draconian. And then in the case where Jim was bringing up, you got a husband sells something at a loss, and then the wife buys it within 30 days before or after, that also has the wash sale rules apply, whether you file a joint return or whether you file a separate return. You're still going to be subject to those rules. Now, if you sell something at a loss and then you have your son or daughter buy that stock within the 30 days, and then down the road they gift that stock to you, you're probably okay in that case because, again, that is a I don't think you'd ever want to go to that trouble.
Yeah, that's kind of convoluted.
That is something that could happen. Now, we've discussed wash sale rules as being bad. There are certain situations where wash sale can be good, and I'll give you an example. Let's say you're chugging along, you're getting close to the end of the year, and you have a stock that's got a $50,000 loss, and you've earned a couple hundred thousand dollars of, let's say, $100,000 of capital gains, and you decide, hey, I want to, and you're in the 15% tax bracket for capital gains. So you decide, I'm going to go ahead and take that loss on December 29th. Well, January comes along, and suddenly you have a $1 million gain from something that you never thought would ever happen. And the key is this has got to happen in January. So in that situation, what you can do is you can trigger the wash sale. So that means that stock that you generated a $50,000 loss on December 29th, you trigger the loss sale rules. That $50,000 loss then gets added on to the stock that you bought on, let's say, January 3rd or January 10th, as long as within 30 days. And then you sell that stock for that extra $50,000 loss to offset the $1 million capital gain that you had that you weren't planning on. So there is a small window.
You know, the planets have to align a special
small,
way.
Small window within December, you know, really within about December 20th and January 30th, somewhere in that window, that maybe you could be in a situation where the wash sales really help you. But generally, wash sales are always going to be penalized. Now, Jim had mentioned that if you have a wash sale occurs in the year and then it's added to that stock and then you sell it down the road, that you're going to end up losing the benefit of that loss in the current year. Technically, that's only true if you sell that stock that you bought in the year after the wash sale applies. If you sell that stock that you bought during the same tax year, you'll get the benefit. You know, it's going to end up being essentially the same benefit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, anything else there, Jim, that we wanted to add on to wash sales?
Yeah, there was. I was going to make mention of.
And I'll point out too that I've not, as long as it's a clean ticker symbol identifier, even though if they are similar in their behaviors, you mentioned like Tesla and Rivian. Yes, they're both electric car companies, but I've seen no reasonable application of the substantially identical interpretation that would disallow. It's two different ticker symbols, kind of as your get out of jail free card. Even if, like Paul, I think you mentioned that, you know, two similar ETFs or mutual funds that at least you were clear in your wording, and I'll agree with you that the custodian won't flag it if it's two different ticker symbols. The IRS may have a different opinion that transaction has a wash sale issue if they were to examine it. So that's where it kind of falls. I still think the IRS would never take two different companies that happen to do the same thing as substantially identical. There's enough nuances, but funds or ETFs that pursue a similar strategy, especially if it's mimicking an index or something, I think you are in jeopardy of, even though if the custodian didn't report it as substantially identical and therefore a wash sale issue, that the IRS on examination would call you out on it.
Well, the reason I mentioned that, though, Chris and Paul, is in 2008, when that same revenue ruling came out about IRAs, the IRS raised the stakes. They purposefully do not define substantially identical for a reason.
They don't want to paint themselves.
They don't want to pigeonhole themselves.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they went a step further and said if the securities aren't necessarily substantially identical, but they are quote unquote highly correlated, that will also be substantially identical. So what do they mean by highly correlated? Highly correlated as far as their stock graphs go? Or highly correlated as far as their line of work, the products they produce, their target market, the people they sell to? What's highly correlated? Again, they didn't define it. It's so openly broad. So I'm just sharing, again, they don't have the software right now, folks, to track all this. Chris knows I'm fascinated by AI and how we can use AI in our practice, not to manage money, but to help us run an efficient practice. And I think that's where AI is really going to help, because it will make a mistake, but it'll only make it once.
Yeah.
And the ability for the IRS in the future to simply say, all trades must be reported to us. And this AI program being able to look not only at substantially identical, but highly correlated across multiple custodians, I think those days are coming. Now, don't get all panicky. This is, we're really just talking and having fun here. But I truly do feel 10, 12, 15 years from now, they're going to be talking about, geez, remember when the IRS couldn't track any of this? So I just wanted to point out, Chris, that highly correlated, undefined, muddies the waters even more. Is Rivian and Tesla highly correlated? I would argue yes.
Well, let's look at another example. Let's take an S&P fund or ETF, S&P 500 ETF. One manager bases it on market value. Another manager just bases it on price. Are those highly correlated? I would say I don't think they are, because we know that, you know, five stocks or six stocks or 10 stocks have been 80% of the gain in the S&P 500. And if you did it based on dollar weighting, they'd have very little, you know, very little weight to the gain that that index might have. So I think it's, you know, it's just interesting. And you're right. IRS is never, ever going to back themselves into a corner as to identify what highly correlated means.
Highly correlated or substantially identical.
Yeah, yeah.
And is it just correlated as far as the equities that are owned in the investment, or is it, in the case of individual stocks, how are they going to define correlated? To me, same market segment, same product, same clientele. That to me seems highly correlated. Again, folks, they can't track this right now.
Yeah.
I'm just talking, broadly speaking, where technology is advancing to the point where these things where we say, oh, don't worry about it, they're never going to be able to catch it if you sold Ford and bought GM, sold Rivian and bought Tesla, sold Mobil and bought Exxon and Mobil or One, whatever, some other oil company.
Although it's funny, in the article that that you mentioned, Jim, I was reading the article, and it mentioned you could they were asking, can you sell Exxon and buy Mobil? And I'm like, it's the same company now. And I was like,
did they have that? Yeah, ExxonMobil is the same. So there you go. That would be
highly correlated.
Exxon's not going to buy a company that's not highly correlated with it, and they kept the same name.
Yeah.
So there it goes. It was Mobil and Exxon, when they were separate companies, highly correlated? I think right there shows it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So
the good news is I don't think they can run AI on their 1970s vintage computers at the IRS yet. So. Yeah. Unless there's a huge modernization there, we've got a little bit of time before this level is out there. But
and we also have to understand wash sale rules only apply to certain assets, stocks, bonds, primarily, crypto as of yet.
I was just going to go that route.
Crypto isn't there. Now we know.
It's exempt.
Yeah, because the IRS a while back, about, 7-8 years ago, determined that it wasn't a security.
Right.
It was property, just like a car or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's personal property.
Yep.
Now, President Biden, in his green book that he came out with, has proposed making it subject to the wash sale rules. I think the Build Back Better Act proposed that. Now, it didn't get passed. So I think eventually, within a few years, that will also be subject to the wash sale
rules. Let me pause you there and go down this rabbit hole. Because when all this was being bantered about, the only way to buy crypto, and we are not crypto experts. I am not pushing crypto. I don't understand it. I don't like it. Yada, yada. If you're a client, we don't even consider it. So let's just clear the air on there. But look at this from the interest in wash sale. That's all I'm doing for any listener and any regulator. I'm not talking about buying crypto. I'm looking at this from a wash sale perspective. Back when crypto, you truly had to buy something called a freaking token, and you had to get it through some exchange and keep it in a digital wallet and all that other crap that I don't understand, and I freely admit it. The point was, you could take a substantial loss in one crypto and immediately run out and buy it back and not violate the wash sale rule because it is property. But now, as of a couple months ago, we have ETFs, which are a security. And we can have an ETF that's dedicated to Bitcoin, which is a crypto. I will go so far as to argue at some point, they being the IRS, is going to say, wash sale applies to that crypto ETF because it's a security you're selling. Doesn't matter what the security owns. I don't think they're going to get right into what the ETF is owning. They're going to say, you sold a security, an exchange traded fund. That's a security. It's not some random non-existent fake token you can only buy online. This is an actual security you can walk into your broker's office and buy. Don't play that game. You will be subject to wash sale. They haven't come out and said that, but I think they will. What says you to?
I totally agree. It's a security. I mean, it's packaged as a security. It was in order for the SEC to allow it to be traded, it by default is a security. So I don't even think the IRS has to come out and say anything. I think by default it is.
Well, but all you people who hear wash sale doesn't apply to crypto. If you have this Bitcoin ETF and it's down and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to take a loss this year and immediately buy it right back so I can use it, and you own it as an ETF structure, I'd be careful.
Yep. No, I agree with that.
Okay. And someday I'll probably be in my 80s. We will rehash this. Hopefully we'll all be around still on the podcast. Because by then AI will be at the point and the computers will be at the point and we'll say, remember when we said way back in 2024? Well, here it is. They're monitoring everything you're doing in lifetime, and they're tracking not just wash sale, but everything. That's spooky, but that's coming.
Sounds like talking to my kids about a rotary phone or a typewriter or a party line.
Well, I know in our office, Chris, where I have my real phone that my grandfather used, a real wood phone with the crank handle, that gets attention when people come in and they see what my grandpa used in the 1920s. Just amazing. My grandfather was born in 1903. And this was the phone that his family had. And now it's on the wall in my office. That was high tech in the 1920s. And it's this big wooden box. And it was all a party line. And when people came in, some people in our office years ago were elderly, and they came in and they used those phones, and it was all a party line. And they explained to me how you listened for the ring to know if you're supposed to pick up or if your neighbor was supposed to pick up, because you might be two shorts, one long, two shorts. That's your ring, and you'd have to pay attention. But he joked and he said it didn't matter. Everybody picked up, and if it wasn't for you, we just listened.
Yeah. You could always tell when they were listening because there would be a different echo on the line, so it was pretty easy to tell.
Yeah, see, I wish they would have kept that for households with kids and stuff, where there'd be special rings for so and so, or because I got really sick of answering the phone.
Well, these days it's only text or Snapchat or whatever.
Now it doesn't matter. Yeah, right? Now it doesn't matter. Everybody has their own phones, their own cell phones, but when you had a bunch of kids in the house and somebody called for one kid specifically, it was kind of a pain. Kind of like the Brady Bunch.
Well, anyways, I know we got to wrap up. We're short on time. But, Paul, thank you for coming on. I think we covered everything I wanted to cover on wash sale and cap gains. People, again, we hope to have Paul and maybe Alan and Steve, the three taxeteers, if you will, on as regular guests on the podcast. And if you have tax questions, Chris will explain to you how to get those to us, and any question really for future shows. We will be, this is an EDU show. We might do one more dialogue EDU to tie everything up, or Chris and I might next week jump right into the whole series we want to do on what we call the secure retirement income process, our entire concept approach from beginning to end, through investing and positioning and see-through portfolio to the creation of your fund number, minimum daily force, secure everything. This will be a lengthy series. I will be starting that soon. So anyways, that's just giving everybody an idea. And doesn't mean we can't have Paul on during that whole series, maybe not for the EDU, but for the Q&A for tax-specific questions.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you want to send in your own questions for the show, either a suggestion for an EDU show or a question for the Q&A show, Best way to do that is to email Jim directly. His email is jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast, and even better, put a short topic, a word or two, keywords in the subject line of the email. That'll catch Jim's attention, especially when he's looking for tax-specific or annuity-specific or IRA-specific questions. And just send those in to him, and he'll file them away, and hopefully we'll get to your question or topic in short order. Sometimes it doesn't happen. We can't answer every single question that comes in, but if you make it nice and concise and as interesting as you can make it, that does increase the chances we'll get to it. So thanks again, Paul. Yeah.
And remember to answer the state hint with the actual state.
Oh, true. That's very helpful. If we the hints are great, but somehow, somewhere, maybe at the bottom or something for Jim, give you the answer so he doesn't have to look it up or guess. That's also helpful. So take care, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.